Hello and welcome to the Boag World Show, the longest running web design podcast where we look at everything relating to user experience, design, conversion rate optimization and working in the web. On this week's show, we're going to discuss deceptive design and the impact that it has on accessibility. My name is Paul Boag and joining me on this episode is Marcus Lillington and Todd Libby. Hello both, how are you doing?
Hello Paul, good, thanks.
Hello Paul.
Hey Todd, it's good to have you on the show. Just so everybody knows, Todd is a long-term friend. I've known him for quite a while now, it's been quite a few years, and is an accessibility expert that sits on the W3C working group and is looking at the moment. I'm spending a lot of time looking at deceptive design, so we thought we'd get him on. But much more important than all of that is obviously the fact that Todd's partner, the lovely Paula, who I got to meet not long ago, is a massive Breathe fan. And so just thinks Marcus is the most wonderful thing ever. So obviously,
she probably
Todd has
doesn't
got,
think I am. She probably thinks that probably David was. I would have thinks more likely.
That's the name that comes up a lot. Yes.
Yeah.
She actually sent me a text about 5 minutes ago saying, "Be gentle."
I have the thickest skin in the world.
I think she meant towards her.
She has a very heavy 80s rotation when we're in the car, and Breathe is a big part of that rotation on the radio. So
that's good. That's all royalties, Marcus. So the more she can play it, the better. No,
it's only if it gets played by a TV station or radio station. So just personal use.
If it's through a streaming service, don't you get something out of that?
Yeah. Tiny
micro amount.
But no, as long as you're not playing it in your shop or in it or anything like that, or part of your play or whatever you're putting on, then you can play it as much as you like.
Oh, okay. Right. Do people own music anymore? Is that a thing? I think everybody just streams it, don't they?
Are you trying to wind me up?
Yeah, because I know it will. Because I suspect you own all your music, don't you, Marcus?
No, I sort of partially own it. No, that's a good question, actually. I still collect royalties via, or royalties are collected via big publishing companies and things like that. So, but I don't think they own the songs anymore like they used to. It's more of a collection. They get a certain smaller percentage because they're collecting rather than actually owning them like in the early days. But you can't give away. You know, it's like Bob Dylan sold all of his songs for 100 million or whatever it was.
Right.
He hasn't. What that means is he's sold the rights for. So this has got nothing to do with what we're meant to be talking about. But anyway, here we go.
That's all right. Todd knows what the show's like. He knew what he was getting into.
But what it means is that I can't remember who bought it, Sony or whoever bought it, mean that they can use Bob Dylan songs in the films that they make without asking him.
But they don't
really own it. He still owns it. But I'm not sure what happened, but back in the sort of early 20th century, a very serious lawyer types obviously got involved in this, very much on the behalf of songwriters. And the rights for, if you write a song, you can't give it away. It's impossible. It's yours forever.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of cool.
But it is. Anyway. No, it's good. So, Todd, how are things going? You seem to be another of these people that I seem to be increasingly encountering as I age, who is kind of semi-retired. But you seem incredibly busy for someone who's supposed to be semi-retired. How's it going these days?
Semi-retired, yes. Not as retired as I'd like to be at this point, but W3C work has taken up a fair amount of time, along with some side projects that I have, and I am currently writing an article on deceptive patterns and the work that I've been doing, possibly next year, to give maybe a talk or two at a conference. We'll see.
Oh, nice.
Later down the road. I've given the talk before, but with all the changes that we've done and all the discussions that we've had and the work that we have done in the safety and deception subgroup that I was a part of for WCAG 3, that talk from 2023 will change a lot. So
everything changes a lot in our world, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, I mean, as we've already touched on the subject of deceptive design, I'll ignore my show notes and we'll jump straight into talking about it, and then I'll come back and talk about personas later, because I do want to touch on them. But so if I understand it correctly, you are taking part in the W3C working group that's helping put together the accessibility guidelines, the third version that is due to come out. And did you say you're working on the what subgroup? Safety and something subgroup.
Safety and deception.
Yeah. So tell me about... Well, first of all, let's start with how you guys are kind of defining deceptive design. And I'm also interested in why that's a part of accessibility guidelines.
So the W3C does not have an official definition, because a few people are wondering if there is a definition to which originally I have to go back to another subgroup I was a part of, which is the functional needs subgroup, that when I originally proposed bringing deceptive patterns to the W3C. And I'm not the only one. I'm not, you know, doing any groundbreaking work here. We defined it as, and I wrote it down here so I have the direct quote right. A deceptive pattern is where there is a deliberate attempt to aim or force a user down a particular path, or to trap attention in a way that redirects or focuses on a goal that the user either does not want or need, or may be harmful to them. So that was our definition. Norman Nielsen Group has a definition on their website, which explains it almost the same, but they also add the piece of that it benefits an organization financially, which is the big part of why there are deceptive patterns out there.
And I'm guessing the primary reason for considering it as a part of accessibility guidelines is for those who are maybe more vulnerable to these techniques because of cognitive disabilities and stuff like that. Is that kind of the angle that you're coming at?
Absolutely. That's one of them. Yeah. And another being, you know, with the social media landscape as it is and has been for decades, the harm behind that as well. I can give you a real quick example with infinite scrolling. And when you're trapped, you know, scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, and you think, couple minutes have gone by, I should probably go get lunch, and it's already dinner time. There's a need for that, I felt, in the guidelines.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's like, how far do you go with this, right? You know, let's take infinite scrolling, for example. Because one of the big things is, you know, at what point are people responsible for their own behavior, So I've just immediately gone off from the questions that I wrote down. It's like, I always do this. Sorry, Todd. You know, at what point do people go, you know, are kind of responsible for their own behavior? And at which point should the W3C advise against certain behavior? You must be struggling to find that line. You know, it must be quite a challenge.
It is a challenge. It is a very fine line, and we're trying to we're trying to figure out what part that we can help with as far as the guidelines go, and what part should we say, well, this is up to the individual, or this is up to, we don't want to be policing that kind of behavior.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from. I've always seen, and I guess this is because I'm a very agency focused view of the world, but I've always seen workout guidelines relating to accessibility as guidelines for people who build stuff like us. And if we don't, obviously we're building stuff for clients, and if those clients tell us, no, we don't care about that stuff that we're telling you, then they're going to get, you know, brought in front of a judge and taken down or whatever. So if we're talking about infinite scrolling, for example, on, you know, doom scrolling on your phone, I mean, is the idea here, if this is adopted, that if Facebook don't change, then they're going to end up in front of a judge? Is that what we're talking about?
That's something that we're trying to not get the W3C into, as far as the legalities of everything, because that's not what the W3C
It's not your remit. I know that. I'm just talking about it.
Right. It's never been the case that W3C is legally enforceable until government choose to adopt it or not adopt it. And they adopt different bits of it, and sometimes they adopt all of it, sometimes they adopt it piecemeal. So it is possible that we could be in a world like that, but I doubt it somehow.
It could be, especially with the litigious nature in the United States. We're a very litigious lot over here.
We've noticed.
But a lot of it is, if we don't want it to go to the point where people think that they're trying to police everything now, because we have that group of people over here that think, you know, they're policing everything. We want to make it kind of along the lines of best practice to say, you know, infinite scrolling is something that you shouldn't do. You know, maybe we could say, and I don't want to come off as like, this is actually what we're doing, but
No. We're not. We recognize all of this stuff is in. All of this stuff is in flux, and we're not holding you as the official representative of the W3C here.
Todd said.
No, I don't want to read that on Hacker News or anything.
No. So, I mean, the W3C has always been very open, hasn't it, about the way that it works and the way that it operates. And that's one of the things I love about it. And so, yeah, we understand that you're not you're not the voice of the W3C.
No, although that would be nor would cool. I want to be.
I don't know, like the voice of God that smites certain bad behavior across the internet. You're shaking your head, but I would love that kind of power, Todd. It's just the way that I think.
Paulo would beg to differ.
I would love it. I think, you know, I was just the example I was just giving. I would think that would be fantastic if the likes of, you know, the hugely powerful get, you know, stop basically behavior that is affecting people, you know, human beings in a bad way. Wouldn't that be a good thing? You know,
that's but this is the thing that I love about the having accessibility guidelines, right? And about adding deceptive patterns into that mix is that it's not one of the big problems I think is not intentional desire to do harm, but almost one of two things, just lack of thinking, right, about the consequences of one's actions and the inevitable institutional pressure that is kind of instinctively applied in a capitalist system, right? So whether you're talking about a small Shopify site or you're talking about a big social media site, the same is true in most situations, that there is a pressure to create more revenue, drive more leads, get more engagement, whatever the thing is. And people will work towards that goal without necessarily being aware that the things that they're implementing are a bad thing. I don't think the likes of Mark Zuckerberg even woke up one morning and went, do you know what? I want to screw over the web. Yeah. You know, whatever you may think, he's just a guy who was trying to make his app successful. And then he had shareholders to deal with and they were putting him under pressure and he was putting pressure on the people below him and so on. And it just kind of happens. But when you've got a set of rules written down that say, no, these are damaging, mm-hmm. right? This kind of behavior has a bad influence. Then really, if people decide to cross that line, they know that they're doing so, and they don't care, right? Mm-hmm. But if you don't write it down, then they can just stumble into this behavior and, you know, without realizing it. At least perhaps I'm being very naive and thinking the world is a nicer place than it is, but that's kind of how I see it.
We had unofficially again come up with a couple of different terms for deceptive pattern and anti-pattern being
okay,
being bad design or bad UX without the intent.
So, okay, interesting. Okay. I like that.
That's the part where, again, you know, bad decision making, or you know, a manager that has not been educated, or even a developer slash designer that hasn't been educated in, hey, you know, best practices dictate that you shouldn't, you know, have a call to action button that is an ad and sends you somewhere where you don't want to go that looks like a button that performs an action that you think you're doing, but it's not. While the deceptive pattern is with intent to lead that person down that road and get them to do something they perhaps do not, and most of the time, you know, do something they don't want to do. So we kind of compartmentalized it that way.
But even that, and I think that's brilliant. I think that's a brilliant way to think about it. But even that is a kind of complicated one, because that's very much a scale, isn't it, from one extreme to the other? Because there are situations where you have to make decisions about a design approach in an interface, and your business objective is to increase more sales mm-hmm. on the website. So how pushy is okay, right?
Yeah.
And that is a difficult line to walk. I've got a mock-up that I use in presentations when I talk about deceptive patterns, and it's basically a mock-up of an e-commerce page to buy a pair of shoes, and there are two buttons at the bottom, right? One which is a bright green button that points onwards and says buy with insurance, and the other one is an outlined button that points backwards that says buy without insurance, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a basically a kind of you're adding something onto the product without people realizing it. Of course, people don't read the buttons properly. They click on the big green button. They end up paying more than they should do, right? Classic example of a deceptive design pattern. But if you're an e-commerce lead in a company, I bet you could convince yourself, oh, well, I'm giving the user a choice, right? They could choose to buy it without insurance. It's not like I'm forcing them into this situation. And so that you've kind of got to be very self-aware of, you know, am I being objective in it? I mean, the rule that I use is it's actually less to do with what I think, whether I believe that it's a anti-pattern or a dark pattern or whatever else, and more how is it going to be perceived by the end user? Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, even if you do something in good faith, if they perceive it as manipulation, then it kind of is, in a way, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, how are you dealing with that kind of sliding scale of things?
So there are examples where I can tell it's a deceptive pattern.
Right.
For instance, a good example being T-Mobile used to have on their website their tiered plans for services, and they'd have the top three that were the most expensive, but to get to the bottom two that were the least expensive, you had to go through a series of clicks to get to that screen showing those two bottom tiered pricing levels, which was the deceptive pattern there. You know, they want you to get the most expensive plan you can, not caring about what your financial situation might be. There are examples of that I've seen that are just anti-patterns that maybe a designer just isn't aware and doesn't understand, you know, the best practices of UX. You know, again, that call to action button that, you know, they may be using a div, but a screen reader can't read it, and they don't, you know, somebody that's blind may not know what they're doing. And it looks like a button, you know?
Yeah.
And they have some sort of, maybe it's an ARIA label or something that says, you know, button to do whatever, for example. And then there are cases where it's like you're on a seesaw and it's like, is it a deceptive pattern or is it an anti-pattern? And that's where it's very subjective to... Mm. Okay, that's up to the user to decide if they feel like they're being deceived or not. And that happens a lot. That happens a lot. I can't tell you the number of times, you know, I've given a talk at a conference and then afterwards somebody's come up to me and said, well, I ran into this problem. I'm thinking, that could go either way. So,
yeah, yeah. And I think the big misunderstanding that a lot of people have when it comes to deceptive patterns, in a lot of cases, not all, but in a lot of cases, I think end users are actually aware that the website is trying to manipulate them. Right. Take that example, that T-Mobile example. If you just looked at the data, you would see a statistical uprise in the number of people buying the highest products, you know, the most expensive products. And you would conclude, ha ha, my manipulative pattern has worked. Mwah, ha ha, I have now succeeded in my aim. But the problem is you've just pissed off a whole load of people that your data doesn't show that you've pissed off, mm-hmm. right? And that has all kinds of hidden costs. I remember once when I went into an e-commerce company and I was working with a company, they sold consumer electronics, things like kettles and stuff like that. And their biggest seller...
Oh, I have a story about that as well.
Anyway, oh, do you really? Yes, yes. Perhaps it's the same company.
Very relevant. Yeah. It might be. I'll tell you in a minute.
So these guys, they had this kind of coffee percolator thing, right? That was their number one seller. And what they would do is they would... I can't remember the name of it, but that thing where it automatically adds all of their filters to the basket alongside the product, right? And which is a classic, you know, deceptive pattern. So you went through, you bought your percolator, and you got these filters. And of course, it's like ink cartridge. You can get cheaper ones online for half the price if you don't buy the brand names, right? But because they bundled it, their sales shot up. And the e-com team was really happy about it. But when I dug around in the company, I discovered, well, I did a search online and discovered the number of people ranting about, you know, this was enormous. And it was actually impacting the marketing's ads, marketing department's ad spend, because so many people were pissed off about it. The number of people ringing customer services has spiked since they'd done it, and the number of people returning the filters, and in fact the whole coffee percolator, because they were pissed off, shot through the roof. But the e-com team was completely oblivious to all of these additional costs. They just saw their number go up and they were happy. Well, Marcus, what's your coffee example?
Quite similar. It was with AO.com, who sell white goods, basically.
Yeah.
And I'd bought, and their website is superb. Or it was. I've not used it for years, but it was superb. And I'd bought a washing machine, I think. And fine, you know, wonderful buying experience. But about two or three days before it was due to arrive, I got a phone call from them. A really heavy sell of insurance.
Oh, yeah.
And to the point of, I got angry, you know, and then I sort of, I kind of like dwelt upon it someone and wrote a post about it in the end, and sort of realized that, you know, this poor guy who basically had rung me up was under huge pressure to sell insurance. Yeah. But just to quickly get to the end of the story, it put me off buying from AO ever again. But of course, the heavy sell of insurance was bringing in the pound notes, if you like. What I was trying to get to is, you need somebody very senior looking at the entire holistic view of the sales process and the ordering process and the post sales and all these kind of things, because. Yeah, because of what you just said, Paul. One little team might be doing really well, but at the detriment, you know, even to the point of like losing more money than they're making.
I got missold by BT once, and it cost them. It must have cost them a fortune in the end, because they had to go through a whole, you know, complaints process with multiple people involved. You know, there were. You know, this huge kind of machine kicked off to assess my case and all the rest of it, all just because one guy got over enthusiastic.
Yes. Anyway, enough of me.
Yeah. So, Todd, this to me feels like we're about, I don't know what you think, but it feels like we're about to enter another era where this could get potentially a lot worse with things like AI driven personalization, and that it might end up with a situation where these patterns are much more harmful to detect or be aware of. Are you noticing a shift? Or because I haven't actually noticed it. I just got this feeling it might happen, but you're paying more attention than I am.
I've not noticed anything that, you know, I have not seen any examples
yet
with AI yet. Yeah, I'm in the same camp. And while I'm not the biggest fan of AI, especially with accessibility, the potential is there to do good, but there's always the bias behind it.
Yeah.
And from what we've seen with places like Silicon Valley, there's a lot of bias.
Yeah.
The one example I can think of with accessibility and AI that actually works is the app Be My Eyes.
Yes, that's amazing, that app. Yeah. Yeah. So essentially, as I understand it, that it allows people with vision problems to take a photograph of something, and it always used to be that it would then go off to a real human who would tell them what they're looking at. But increasingly, I think they're beginning to use AI to do that kind of stuff. The other thing that I like, and I think is beginning to benefit all of us from a kind of cognitive disability point of view, is the ability to get shit explained to us in a way we can understand. Mm-hmm. So you know, to be able to take all those terms and conditions that we have to sign up to and put it through, you know, something like ChatGPT and get it to explain it so we know what we're committing to. Those kinds of things, I think, have got a lot of potential. But I also can't help but feel like there's going to be ways that they're just going to use this to screw us over and to manipulate us. And but I haven't seen too much. I'm just waiting for the shoe to drop on that one.
I am as well. And I had a conversation about this the other day where I said, well, there's some evil overlord in his 20s rubbing his hands together and cackling, you know, of the possibilities of doing just that, what you just said.
I mean, the one thing that I think gets into the anti-patent territory is this increased thing of you having to go via a chatbot, an AI chatbot, before you can speak to a human. We're seeing a lot of that. And I don't personally, by my personal definition, I don't think that's an anti-patent so much. I think companies are just trying to save money and aren't really thinking about the consequences of what they're doing there. But it certainly creates a frustration for all of us, and even more of a frustration for maybe people that aren't as technically savvy or, you know, have got some form of cognitive disability or, you know, a visual impairment, for example, might not get on as well with that. They just want a telephone number where they can bloody call somebody. And that's increasingly hard to get at. So, you know, that's the only one I can think of off the top of my head. But I'm sure people will, you know, suggest more, because it's going to be a huge area. I've no doubt whatsoever. So what advice would you give, you know, to... I know that there are marketers that listen to this. I know that there are UX designers that listen to this, who find themselves under pressure to deliver results, whether it be, you know, Marcus and his clients, me and my clients, whether it be in-house teams, whoever else. What advice would you give us in order to help us A, make the case against doing this kind of thing, and B, where to draw the line in all of this?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's a tough question, because, you know, you want to say, I especially want to say, you know, think of the harm that may be caused with a deceptive pattern that... you know, potentially is going to be made and eventually is made. But like with accessibility, doing the right thing, normally big companies don't do the right thing. They do the thing that puts money in their wallets. And, you know, when, you know, the word lawsuit comes up, it's the big companies just say, we'll let legal handle that and settle out of court. And that's how they sweep it under the rug. What I would say is, be the one that starts possible change at your organization. Advocate for change. And if it's resisted, I know these days if there's pushback, that could cause problems for the person that is doing the pushback, but I've always been the one that's been like, you know, I'm going to push back, and I go rogue a lot. but, you know, we all need to work, and I get it that there might be a cranky manager CEO that says no, and, you know, if you put up any more of a fuss about it, you know, you can find somewhere else to work. Advocate and start with a manager, I think would be the first place that I would go, and kind of, and it falls under that, you know, do good things, you know just start with your manager and see if you can work your way up to possibly the top. When I used to do consulting, accessibility consulting, I'd always go to the top and say, listen, you know, and approach it from a financial aspect where you have a very large group of people, disabled people, that have a very large disposable income. Mm. You know, measuring in the U.S., the last figure I had was in the, you know, I think it was $500 million in disposable income. Worldwide, it's probably doubled, maybe even tripled at this point.
Yeah.
Start there. Do you want a piece of that pie or not? And make, yeah, make your stuff accessible.
And also, you know, then you can, I agree, you've got to, there's no point of trying to make the ethical argument within organizations, yeah, because in my experience, people can justify anything in their own heads to convince themselves they're being ethical and doing the right thing. But if you position it from a financial point of view, you know, the hidden costs associated with it, the lost, you know, lost audiences associated with it, those kinds of things, then you tend to get much further. And what you're saying about a disabled audience and the spending power of a disabled audience, you can actually expand even further, because there's a huge number of us that, you know, that have got temporary or situational disabilities that make that even bigger. You know, the number of times as a 54-year-old man with crappy vision, I've just gone, screw this website, I can't bloody read anything on it. You know, there's that kind of thing as well. And the older you get, I know my mother, for example, you know, there have been websites that she's worried, she's specifically worried is trying to con her. Right. Yep. And is trying to screw her over. And so I get this call and I said, well, just buy it somewhere else instead, you know? So there actually is a huge business case, and you're right. It just takes us to stand up and be kind of advocates and start going, are we aware of the cost that goes with this, you know, this decision that we're making? And as long as we're aware of it. And the one that I use quite a lot is, can I just drop you an email outlining the reasons why this is, you know, I'm concerned about this, just in case there's any blowback, I want an email. And of course, nobody ever wants to say, you know, to receive an email like that, because then they're on the hook for it.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
so.
I think you can take the ethical approach with that, you know, explaining the financials behind
it. Oh yeah, I'm not saying you never mention the other. And yeah, it very much also depends on the organization. So for example, I work with a lot of government bodies, I work with a lot of higher education institutions, I work with a lot of charities. All of those, of course you can make the ethical argument, you know, they're very open to it. And but even there, even within like higher education at the moment, there's been a whole load of new accessibility legislation that's come in, and they've left it to the last minute. And they're panicking about it now, not because they feel that it's the right thing to do, but just because, you know, oh, we must get this sorted because we're, you know, we've got a responsibility towards this.
Yeah.
So obviously a big part of the arsenal here is being able to point to the W3C and say, look what they say. Is there any kind of time scales about when this stuff is going to be out in the world? Is there anything you're aiming for, even if you don't meet it?
We have a working draft of WCAG 3, which is online.
Ooh.
And it's very early.
Okay.
And we are working. There's a lot of, you know, brilliant people working very diligently and very hard to make it, you know, work. I don't want to say, well, it's going to be, you know, this year, and blurt out a number, but
no,
I have seen 2029, 2030 for WCAG.
Right.
And it's very involved. You know, there's a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I know. Yeah. But even the fact that you have a working draft, right, is often enough. Can you send me a link to that working draft?
I can.
I'll put it in the show notes.
I can.
And the reason being is because you can just go, look, this is what WCAG are going to do. This is the direction that they're going. Notice this big section on you know, deceptive patterns. We've only got a little while to sort our shit out before the government start adopting this kind of, because that's what inevitably happens, isn't it? So
it's usually the last, they wait until the last week
to say,
oh, we better get on this now.
Yeah. But is that not a universal human trait that applies to us all?
Oh, I do it every day, Paul. I do it every day.
Well, I don't do it every day. I do it once every 2 weeks.
Yeah. I should space it out a lot more like that myself, yeah.
I was always doing my homework, not on Sunday evening, on the bus to school on Monday morning.
That's impressive, Marcus. That's above and beyond. So, I mean, the last thing that I would leave people with, and this is my really subtle transition into the next section, is that, you know, make sure as well that the personas that you've created around your different user segments actually do represent a cross-section of users that include people with cognitive and physical disabilities in them. And it's not like, that doesn't mean you have to create a persona, you know, here's our disabled persona, right? Because you can have your normal set of personas, but just, you know, some of those people have, you know, accessibility needs as well. And then that gives you, again, a foot in to be able to start talking about this stuff, because you can say, well, Janice has got, you know, dyslexia or, you know, ADHD or whatever. You know, we need to bear that in mind. So, and that brings me so subtly, I'm really proud of this transition. Nobody will notice it to the subject of personas.
Can I say before you do that the yes. W3C does have a page with personas?
Does it really?
It does. Ooh, I will get you that link.
Yes.
I'll be very
lovely.
Interested to see that. I'll explain.
Yeah,
just
that would be good. The trouble is, you guys put out so much information that it's really hard to stay on top of it all. It's like you've got all this good stuff out there. Yeah. Do you know what? It's hard to access. That's the problem.
So I know, and a lot of people in accessibility have said this, you know, the current guidelines are very difficult to read because it's like a technical manual.
Yeah.
With WCAG 3, we are heading towards using more clear and plain language so that people just starting out in accessibility and just starting to learn about accessibility can easily understand that. So hopefully, you know,
it is actually a bit of an issue, isn't it? Because I mean, I struggle with it. And increasingly these days, you know, I will take guidelines like that, not specifically that, and just feed them into ChatGPT and have conversations with it about what I should be doing instead, because otherwise it is overwhelming. Mm. So on the subject of personas, I did just want to talk about a little bit about personas and how I'm changing my approach recently. It's really just a random tip to kind of help people out. But I saw this great thing on social media recently saying about why most personas suck, and because they're kind of marketing orientated and they haven't really changed since the 1950s. And it was saying that they're all built around demographics and that you just shouldn't build personas around demographics. You should build them around needs and tasks and questions and objections and all of those kinds of things. And the example that they give, which I absolutely love, is that if you had personas that were built around demographics, King Charles and Ozzy Osbourne would be in the same persona, right? And this is why. Both are male, both are born in 1948, both are raised in the UK, both have been married twice, both live in castles, and both are wealthy and famous, right? So it kind of shows you how personas built around demographics are a complete and utter waste of time. And so it kind of, I'm a huge fan of personas. I think they're really valuable if they're done right, right? So I think they're really good for building empathy with users. I think they help focus our product development and our decision making about things like dark patterns and other things, you know, on the user and the consequence on the user. I think they're a great shared reference point for making those kinds of design decisions. And I think they're really good for things like prioritizing features based on user value. And they're good for reducing arguments about what users want by grounding some discussions in some kind of research. But I recognize that a lot of teams are struggling to find the time and the budget to create new personas that aren't so based around, you know, kind of demographics. And and there's this kind of attitude of, oh, we've already got personas. So I've introduced this new concept. Well, I haven't. I stole it off of somebody online. Obviously, no, nothing's ever original, is it? Where somebody else started talking about the idea of functional personas. So instead of marketing personas, these are functional personas, which are based, you know, on things like needs, goals, pain points, questions, objections, that kind of data. And that you can create these really simply and really easily with the help of AI, right? So what you do is you just gather everything that you know about your users. And it might be random testimonials that you've got. It might be even letting AI loose at all your emails, going back through all your conversations with users, all your customer interactions with users. It might be that you've got a customer support FAQ system. It might be, you know, whatever. Use previous user research that you've done, anything you can find that mentions the user. And even if you can't do that, because you don't have anything, you can get AI to go off and do deep research into what people are saying about either your product or your competitors or the marketplace as a whole. Bring all of that together and get it to suggest a set of personas that it thinks you should have based on that knowledge. And then you can get it to go away and basically to create this draft personas for you that you can then validate internally by showing it to different people. You can show it to some end users and get their results of it. And of course, those aren't as good as, you know, well-researched, well-considered, well-constructed personas. But it's better than nothing, and it gets people away from thinking about demographics and gets people thinking about kind of needs and that kind of stuff. So I'll put a link in the show notes to an article that I've written on this, kind of outlining how to go about creating these. And please don't spam me saying, oh, we shouldn't be using AI for personas. We should be doing it all the old-fashioned way and doing it. Yes, I know. I know that we should be, but a lot of us, you know, are having to work in a fast moving environment where they're not going to give me the time to do that. And I'd prefer to have some kind of representation of who the users are than no representation at all. So that's my kind of attitude towards it. So if you want to learn more about either those WCAG guidelines or the WCAG personas or my article on personas, you can get to any of them by going to boag.world/23. Marcus, you're putting your hand up like we're at school.
Please, sir. Please, yes. Sir, can I say something?
No.
We have got, we're doing a project at the moment, developing personas and user journey mapping, that kind of thing. And, you know, our client's spending money on it. But the challenge that we have, that I'm going to put to you guys here, is the kind of finished persona. This client doesn't want the personas to have names. They don't want to have photographs associated with them because they don't want to be stereotyped into this particular persona is a black person or female or whatever.
Yeah.
So, but when we've kind of discuss this around them a bit, but we're obviously saying that a persona needs something that you can hang your coat on, you know, or you need to be able to remember it. You know, it needs to be in people's minds. When I'm writing this piece a year down the line, I'm a writer at whatever, you need to have the personas in your head. So if it's just a bunch of kind of like this, you know, this type of persona has these wants and needs, but hasn't got a name, hasn't got a picture, hasn't got anything like that associated with it, how do you create that kind of hook? We think silly names might be a way of doing it, but we're not sure.
I think it's a terrible idea. I think you do that. That kind of undermines the personas to some degree. Although I understand their logic, and it almost is in line with what I was just saying about don't go down the demographics route. So
yeah, exactly.
I'm not.
It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. I don't know what I think. I think if I did it, I would probably do it. Because I'm a massive nerd, I'd probably do it with various aliens. Like I'd have a Klingon persona, and I'd have a ET persona or something like
that's
that.
That's a thought. Yeah, something that's obviously ridiculous, but you could use it as a thing that you attach to the persona. So even though it has nothing to do with, because it has nothing to do, it's fine. That's an interesting interesting point. Yeah,
or inanimate objects or animals.
Yeah, or even colours maybe. I don't know.
I've seen animals done, and they've picked animals where the animal is kind of representative of the persona to some degree, like the wolf, you know, or the, you know, that's a team player but kind of quite aggressive, or the panda, and you know, that might work.
Quite like that. Thank you, Paul. Okay, that's obviously at least £100 worth of consultancy there.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'll be invoicing you for that.
I might have a link for you, Marcus, that would help too. We have, for the W3C, we have a editor's draft of proposed personas, which is just some text with, there are names and titles, but there's also 3 to 4, maybe 5 scenarios that they use. So I can send that link.
Very much appreciated. Thank you, Todd.
Okay, so Marcus, what's your joke to wrap us up with? Sorry, right. Todd, you knew what you were getting into when you came along to the show. You know this is a part of the torture.
I do. Are. Yes.
I told a joke on a Zoom meeting and nobody laughed. Turns out I'm not even remotely funny.
Oh, I like
that's
that.
That's a good one.
That is a good one.
I like that one.
That is a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so groan worthy that it goes into being good. I love it. Hey, Todd, thank you so much for coming on the show, mate. It was really good to have you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Marcus.
You are, in my opinion, one of the, anybody who works on the W3C is a hero. Thank you for your service, sir.
Right.
Because I would kill myself sitting in that number of meetings and working groups with people that are thinking so deeply about things.
Imagine having to come up with the documentation as well.
Oh, and having to really think through the consequences of everything you're doing. That is not me. So I really appreciate that there are people in the world that do that kind of stuff. So thank you very much. And please thank everybody else that in your working group as well, because it is hugely appreciated. You guys are amazing.
Thank you. I will do that.
All right. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed it. And we will be back again in another month. Maybe with a guest. Maybe not. Who knows? If you fancy being on the show and you've got something to talk about, please do drop me a line. It would be lovely to hear from you. And talk to you next time. Goodbye.